Larry Schimmerin is the Managing Director and Chief Economist for the Economic Strategy Institute. He has more than 25 years' experience as an economic consultant to an impressive list of major Fortune 500 companies, financial institutions, and government agencies. Dr. Schimmerin draws on his expertise in business analysis and forecasting to provide straightforward economic insights. Today, Dr. Schimmerin will analyze some key factors that will influence business performance in Oklahoma City. So, Dr. Schimmerin, welcome to the stage.
Rhonda, thank you very much, and I'm going to offer an apology right off the bat. I flew here yesterday from Florida, but for whatever reason, my voice decided not to come with me. And so my throat is a little raspy, but it should be okay with the help of this microphone. And Rhonda, you did a great job moderating that panel, and it is not easy. I moderated a panel a couple of weeks ago with two economists on the panel, and the topic was the stock market outlook. So I call the first economist up, and he comes up, goes through a ream of data, then made a very logical presentation with the conclusion that this implies the stock market's going to go higher. It was very impressive, so I said, you know, I think you're right. Then the other economist came up. He gave the same data, the same statistics, had his approach, and concluded the stock market's going to go down. And it looked very credible to me, so I said, I think you're right. Just then, someone from the audience raises his hand and says, Larry, you said the guy who said the market's going up is right, and you said the guy that said the market's going down is right. They can't be both right. And I thought for a minute, and I said, you know, I think you're right. And of course, with that little story, I agree with everything the panel said, even when they contradicted each other. No, my focus today is going to be mostly on the key national business and economic issues. I am well aware of what a terrific place this is to live and work, and I'm certainly aware of the fact that the economy here is booming relative to the rest of the country. Of course, there have been other times historically when that wasn't the case. But I also know that some national trends, national factors, whether we have a national recession or interest rates and you know what the Fed's going to do, or changes in the federal budget, or other factors, oil markets, oil prices, will impact this region just like it impacts every region in the United States. So that will be my focus today. I will cover, I think, all of the issues that you now read about, the state of the economy, inflation, the stock market, what's happening, is inflation or deflation going to happen, and so forth. And I'm going to do it with three ground rules. Number one, I will not throw out dozens of numbers. There are just a couple of gee whiz statistics that I think are useful. So I hope not to confuse the issue with a lot of data. Secondly, I will try not to use much economic jargon. I am being sensitive to the fact that it is difficult work to have to listen to five economists in 2 hours. So I will try not to sound like an economist. And thirdly, if you're expecting a doom and gloom presentation, you got the wrong guy. I have been relatively optimistic about the economy and the markets for a long time. I remain optimistic, as and I'll explain in a moment. I think we have started now a period which will turn out to be the best in terms of economic growth and general macroeconomic performance across the United States at any time since before the Great Recession and stock market meltdown 5 or 6 years ago. So with that sort of brief overview, let me start with just a quick recap of recent economic performance in the United States. I think all of you remember, even though this region came through it relatively well on a national basis, that recession I just referred to back in 08 and 09 was the deepest we've had in this country since the Great Depression in the 1930s. And you might think that I lived through that personally. Close, but I didn't. So I'm only reading from the history books. But this was serious stuff. This was the scariest economic environment I have ever witnessed personally. We were basically in free fall. Not only in the economy, not only was economic activity dropping rapidly and national jobs being reduced by about 750,000 a month. Extraordinary decline in jobs and employment in this country. At the same time, the stock market dropped nearly 60% over an 8-month period from when Lehman Brothers announced bankruptcy in September of 2008 until early 2009. That was the third biggest decline in the stock market in the history of this country. The first and second both occurred during the 1920s and 30s during that Great Depression. Market dropped 90% in 1929-30. After it recovered some, then it dropped again by 70 or so in 1935-1936. Nothing even close to that has happened since then until 2008 and 2009. I don't know how all of you reacted, but both personally, as well as being a professional economist and trying to advise my clients, I was scared. And in fact, I think fear is one of the main reasons why that free fall kept picking up momentum on the downside. It became a free fall. Because not only were we losing jobs, most people in this country were afraid they might lose their job. And when you're losing a job or think you might, you're not out buying a new house or a new car. It tends to dampen spending below what the fundamentals would suggest, and it just reinforces and accelerates the trend downward. And, you know, if you are as involved in it as I was, and looking at the numbers every day, it was extraordinarily scary. Well, I think all of you know, in the spring of 2009, the stock market bottomed after this excruciating decline. And in July of 2009, about a year and a half into the recession, and by the way, the recession was about a year and a half, but it was the last 8 or 9 months that, you know, accounted for most of the decline. The economy bottomed out in July of 2009 and has been growing ever since. It has been growing rather erratically. We've had some periods of a few months when the economy gained a little steam, and it turned out to be a head fake, and things would slow down again over the next several months. Then we'd get a little blip up and another slowing after a couple of months. On average, in this 5-year, what is it now, 3 months since July of 2009, economic growth measured by GDP has been on average at an annual rate of about 2.2%. This is far and away the slowest economic recovery in our history. Generally speaking, in the early stages when we recover from recessions, even the mild ones we used to have, let alone a deep one like this, the economy starts off growing 5 or 6%. And over a 4 or 5 years, cumulative economic growth is about 25%. Mid-20s, sometimes a little lower, sometimes a little higher. So far in the 5 years plus of this recovery, cumulative economic growth is 2.2%, less than half of what the historical age is. Extraordinary. So we had a deep decline followed by a much slower than normal recovery. It's no wonder why a lot of people either aren't benefiting from the recovery or don't think there has been one at all. And by the way, just to give you one other historical perspective, going back to 1840, which is now 170 some odd years, we have had 33 business cycles in the United States. A business cycle being a period of 4 or 5 years where the economy grows, then it peaks out, we get a recession. Most recessions have been in the range of 12 months, 11 months, let's say a year. Then the economy bottoms and the next growth phase starts. And of course, because we've had a record of economic growth, we always grow more in the recovery period, and it lasts longer, than we decline in the recession period. So historically, recessions have primarily been one-year interruptions in a process of trend economic growth. And as you know, economic growth on a trend basis has been over 3% a year historically. So this last 5-6 years is a complete aberration. And by the way, if you do the arithmetic, 33 business cycles in 170 some odd years, the average business cycle is 5 to 6 years, 4 to 5 being expansion, and the 1 year roughly being recession. So, and you can see how unusual this period has been. What made the recovery so slow? I mean, we don't have enough time to go back and look at what caused the recession. Most of you know it started out with overbuilding of homes, you know, dead people and cats and dogs were getting mortgages in 2005. And then, of course, a lot of these loans became non-performing loans, these mortgages, and the banking system took huge hits. That started the process. Then it affected government. Most local governments in the United States depend primarily on property taxes. When the housing markets collapsed, this reduced their property tax collections by a huge amount. Believe it or not, from 2008 to 2011, state and local governments all combined, including states now, because they suffer too as their revenues from sales taxes and income taxes went down, cut jobs by 600,000. That is, in early 2012, there was 600,000 fewer people working for state governments and city governments around the United States. You may think that's good, but in the short term, it obviously creates more unemployment by definition, a weaker economy, and it just accelerates the downward spiral we were in. Never happened before, because we never had a housing collapse like this to this extent, which reduced their tax revenues to the extent we experienced during this period. On top of that, with all the non-performing loans, banks were interested in two things during that period: raising capital and getting out from under all the non-performing loans, a lot of them mortgages, but others as well, as the rest of the economy started declining in response to what was happening in housing markets and other markets as well. So we had big budget cuts, and some tax increases, which my humble opinion, and I'll talk about what's happening in Washington more a little later, was misguided in terms of timing. Just to illustrate the point I'm now making with one number, I just mentioned a minute ago that average economic growth over this 5-year plus recovery period is a little over 2%. If you split that number in two parts, private sector and government, economic growth in the private sector has averaged 3% a year during this period. Economic growth in government has been minus 0.8% a year. That's how much of a drag on economic growth all these government cutbacks have caused during that period. And of course, housing was still a mess even 2-3 years ago. We overbuilt homes and condos and apartments by more than 1 million during that housing bubble. That has to be absorbed. So new building completely collapsed. You're all aware of that. Not so much in your area, but nationally, and in some areas in particular. I mean, they still haven't dug out from the overhang of all that overbuilding. I mentioned banks weren't lending during that period. People weren't borrowing or spending because they were afraid. We kept hearing some economists talk about a double dip, that after 6 months of the recovery, we're going to go into another recession, which was absolutely ridiculous from the start, but people believe it. So you had all of this digging out from fear and uncertainty and the weakness in all these sectors of the economy that made that such a deep recession. Most of these things have now gone in the other direction. One of the reasons why the economy is not only growing more rapidly right now, but why, in my opinion, this is not a head fake, and this is the start of something that will continue at this pace for 3 or 4 years. In fact, if we're growing 3% right now, which is a good estimate, we're going to have to grow 4 years just to get up to the cumulative 25% growth during the whole recovery period. And by the way, even though the average business cycle historically has been 5 or 6 years, the three longest have all happened in the last 40 years. In the 1990s, we had a 10-year period of uninterrupted growth without recession. In the 1980s, we had an 8-plus-year period of growth without recession. And the 1960s was 7 and a fraction. So except for the last 10 or 15 years, the recent history is encouraging about the length of expansion periods. And in particular, since we had such a deep recession and slow recovery, it's more logical, I think, to expect a continuation of this recovery for a longer period rather than the average of 5 years, which we've already used up. So don't let anybody tell you that we're due for recession because, you know, we've already grown 5 years. That's not the case. We can grow far longer than that and probably will during this period. Why will we? Well, let's look at the economy right now and talk about why we've accelerated from that 2.2% to something now around 3%, and one reason I think is obvious, and that's the improved financial condition of most state and local governments in the United States. We were talking at lunch a minute ago. 42 of the current, not the current, 42 of the 50 states are now running budget surpluses. These are state governments, mostly because tax revenues are coming in faster than they predicted because the economy, the performance of the macro economy has been somewhat better. They are no longer cutting spending and cutting jobs. They're raising it because they have the tax revenues to support it in most states. A neighboring state here, close by anyway, Kansas is not in that situation, but you are and most others are. Secondly, we've had huge budget cuts at the federal level, including very large cuts in the defense budget as the modernization of weapon systems that took place during the decade of the 2000s, particularly new jet fighters, and they're using sensor technology now and more weapon systems and whatever. On top of that, we spent $150 billion a year in Iraq and Afghanistan at the peak. That's being cut back. Secondly, some social programs have been cut. And thirdly, we've raised some taxes. Again, from my perspective, the timing was bad, although long-term, we need to reduce budget deficits. But now, you know, that's not happening. The deficit is way down as the economy's picked up, and fiscal policy now is probably relatively neutral. It's not stimulating the economy much, but it's not holding it back like it did over the last several years. Secondly, housing has started to turn up a little bit. Not booming like it normally does in the early stage of recovery periods because interest rates drop during those periods, but it's moving higher. That's making a contribution. Oil prices, and this may surprise most of you, did you know that oil prices have come down recently? I'll talk more about OPEC and oil in a few moments, but that's helping, at least it's helping the consumers and the industry that use oil, and again, I'll elaborate that in a moment. This is big numbers, by the way. At current price, gasoline prices, at least regular gasoline nationally, are down about 75 cents a gallon since the summer. That's about $72 or $73 billion a year in savings for the average consumer. 60% of American families live week to week or month to month. They don't save. They spend whatever income they have. And when oil prices go down, and they save gasoline prices in particular, save $10 a week, which is the average, that a significant amount of that gets spent on other consumer goods and services. That's helping at the moment. If you've seen the retail sales statistics and other data on consumers, spending is growing more rapidly now, and that's one of the reasons. You know, I can go down there, banks are lending again. Even small business loans, which didn't exist 3 years ago, now on a rising trend. Mortgage lending is still tight, but not quite as tight as it was before. So that's helping a little at the margin. But what's really happening is we had 7 or 8 factors which were dragging down economic growth. There are others I didn't even mention. Most of those now have gone to neutral, or in some cases, a modest positive, and that's why we've turned. And it's become more broad-based. We're seeing a lot of business equipment, manufacturing industries, capital goods, now getting rising orders, which didn't exist. There was so much capacity because of how weak the economy was, and because companies were afraid to make new investments. They didn't know whether this modest pickup from this economic disaster would continue. They were cautious. Now they're starting to spend to replace their old capital goods that are wearing out and are probably technologically obsolete in many cases. So there's not one overriding factor. I can cite you 10, and I've probably done half of them at least already. That's what's accounting for this. But there are some other factors that are still limiting in growth. This is still a modest housing recovery, not contributing as much as it normally does to the recovery in the economy. As I said a minute ago, mortgage lending is easing up, but now you have to be alive and breathing to get a mortgage, unlike 6 or 7 years ago. The dollar has increased in value. And by the way, the world is not linear. Don't believe anybody who tells you that a stronger and stronger and a stronger dollar is good. It is not. When the dollar gets overly strong, some economists will tell you it's a gift to consumers because then we can import products cheaper. What about the producers who get knocked out by this? And if the dollar strengthens enough, it will mean eventually that we cutbacks in spending on production and then spending to follow that as jobs are lost will exceed the benefit of lower import prices and hurt the economy. As you know, the dollar has strengthened in the last several months, but it had dropped, it has been overvalued for years, and it dropped dramatically, allowing us to compete favorably in export markets. That helped the recovery so far. Now starting to move the other direction as the dollar has strengthened some, I don't think you're going to see the growth in exports in the next year match what it's been over the last year or so. So that will hold us back a little bit in terms of economic growth. I think when you look at the full story, we're going to have continued growth in the range of 3%, more broad-based, both geographically and across industries, as we go through the next several years. There are three or four issues that we need to address to, in fact, reinforce that conclusion, at least about the outlook that I expect. And after I do that, I'll talk a little about the stock market, and we'll talk about oil and gas. First, I'm sure everybody in this room has seen 100 articles over the last 5 years that what the Fed is doing through QE3 that Bob mentioned earlier in the panel discussion, buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities and pumping cash into the system, which they pay for those bonds by putting cash in the system, that this is going to cause widespread hyperinflation. No, it won't. And I see some people now talking about deflation. As I mentioned earlier, we're not going to have inflation or deflation, just plain inflation. Why are we not going to have inflation? Number one, most of QE3 has had a little, very minor impact on the economy. Most of that is now sitting at Federal Reserve, at the accounts of commercial banks, at Federal Reserve banks in the United States as excess reserves. $3 trillion of it. We never had excess reserves. I don't think it ever exceeded $400 or $500 billion, let alone $3 trillion, until now. You know, and we talked a bit, banks weren't lending, they were trying to, and demand for credit was low. You can't force people to borrow. So it didn't stimulate the economy that much. Yeah, it helped keep long-term interest rates a little lower than they might have been. The biggest impact, in my opinion, is psychological. Some people and some companies felt better that the Fed is there and will prop us up again in one way or another if the economy dropped again. Monetary policy has been always far more effective when they try to slow the economy by reducing credit availability and raising interest rates than when trying to stimulate the economy by lowering interest rates and raising credit availability. And this was an extreme case of it. And the people who are telling you not only the money supply hasn't grown that much, because money supply only grows when those reserves are lent and money is created, spending goes up. Didn't happen, only to a very minor extent. Then you have others who are saying the stock market is, you know, temporarily boosted by all this liquidity in the system. Baloney. I'll get to that back in a moment. It has had very little effect, QE3, on the economy, inflation, or the markets. Why am I optimistic that we won't get inflation? In part because QE3 is not an inflationary thing. It hasn't raised the money supply that much. The U.S. economy has changed dramatically over the past 40 or 50 years. Someone mentioned earlier, it may have been Bob or Russell, I can't remember who, in the panel discussion, talking about wages. Look at the role of unions in the United States economy. Go back 30 or 40 years. When the auto workers, the steel workers, the machinists, and other big unions in the United States were extremely successful in getting their companies to push up their wages, push up their benefits, and they all had cost of living escalator clauses in it. So if the CPI went up, the consumer price index, they would get a further increase in their wages or salaries on top of what was negotiated in the contract. And what would happen? Do you remember the 1970s? We had an oil price shock, you're all aware of it. Crude went from, what was it, $3 a barrel to whatever in 1973. That increased gasoline and heating oil prices, increased the consumer price index. GM and all those unionized industries had to increase their wages to their workers. That raised their costs, so they raised prices of their products. And before you knew it, we had a wage price spiral. Some of you probably are too young to remember it. You know, we had 12 and 13% inflation in this country in the late 70s and early 80s? Largely because I worked for IBM then. And one of my jobs at IBM was to make sure that we pay our workers good enough so they won't try to unionize our company. So I got pretty knowledgeable about wage trends around the United States and union contracts and whatever, because I worked with the compensation people. So we did the same. We raised our wages just to keep competitive, and our costs went up. And this ratcheted throughout the economy. Do you see any unions now getting big wage increases and having big cost of living adjustments? Most of their bargaining these days is to prevent givebacks. So that is a structural change. And in fact, for the last 6, 7, maybe 8 years, wages among unionized workers have gone up less rapidly on average than non-union workers. Not in every case, but on average. Extraordinary. Secondly, look how competitive the economy has become. Talk about the auto industry. Do you remember when Chrysler, Ford, and GM, and most other industries as well, were dominated by two or three companies, manufacturers? You know, now you've got more domestic competitors, but in the case of the automobile industry, there are 26 foreign-based companies selling cars in the United States market. You know, go back to 1970, the big three had 90-some-odd percent of the U.S. car market. It dropped below 50. It says moved back up a little over 50 now during that period. That has restrained price increases in many industries. Look at retailing. I mean, now you can buy at a traditional department store, one of these new mega stores, you know, Walmart or Office Staples or Home Depot, those kind of stores. You can buy online. You can buy on the internet. If there are any left, you can buy at small retailers. Retailing has become extraordinarily competitive. And most retailers can't raise prices, especially since one of their biggest competitors is Walmart. And Walmart just does not accept price increases from their vendors and doesn't raise prices to the consumers, for the most part. Obviously, there are a few exceptions. But retailing has gotten so competitive that the freedom to raise prices doesn't exist anymore throughout the retail sector. I mentioned foreign competition. In a lot of industries, particularly as the economy has been sluggish, you're getting new domestic companies moving into some industries or some geographic areas to compete with everybody else who is there because they want to grow their revenues faster. It is deregulation. I talked about manufacturing. You know, it's only been 26 years, I think, since long-distance telephone service, which was an AT&T monopoly, regulated by one of the federal regulatory agencies, was broken up, and we now have competitive phone service. Now you not only can go to Sprint, or I guess MCI is not there anymore, but one of the other providers, you can use your computer to make telephone calls. It's extraordinary. Your cell phones, extraordinary. How much competition there is in telecommunications now. Even at the local level, we've begun to see it, as I think most of you know. Electric power is slowly being deregulated. Banks, you know, years ago under Glass-Steagall, they couldn't sell insurance, they couldn't get in the brokerage business. Unfortunately, in my opinion, that was rescinded, and they've all done that, so they become competitors for the other financial institutions in these other markets and industries. And I think it led to some of the excesses of the last 10 years, but we'll skip that for now. I can spend the next half hour talking about other structural, long-lasting changes to this economy that have changed the... We had a bias in this country years ago toward inflation. When the economy would get better and better, this would give companies more freedom to raise prices. They generally had very limited number of competitors. And quite frankly, when I was at IBM, and I was involved in the planning and budgeting process, our costs went up, we raised prices. That doesn't happen anymore in most cases. Most companies I work with now start their annual planning with the assumption they can't raise prices. And they work backwards. How am I going to improve efficiency and productivity to make sure I can maintain my profits and profit margins? It is a complete flip-flop from the way they did things years ago. And plus, we have way global overcapacity in most industries now. There is no chance of any significant acceleration in U.S. inflation in a long, long time. Certainly 5 years, if not longer. And we haven't had any. Look what happened in the 1990s. We had the biggest boom in our history. We had no inflation. Unemployment was down nationally to 3.8%. Did you see any inflation? So why these inflation predictors are still out there, I do not understand. And you see commodity prices? I mean, there's not a real close relationship between overall inflation and commodity prices. The only one that's big enough to affect it significantly is oil, of course. But they're going down, not up. The dollar is stronger. That holds down inflation. Wage increases may be accelerating a little bit, nowhere near where they need to be to push up costs, because companies are finding ways to increase productivity, a lot of it through new technologies. Not only do they start their budgeting with the assumption they can't raise prices, one of the highest priorities in every corporation now, how do I improve productivity and efficiency? I mean, when you think about it, you got to get 3% better each year just to offset your cost increases, or 2% better, just to stay in the same place. And they're doing it, and they're going to continue to do it, particularly as more of the new productivity tools start spreading to companies who are not yet using it. All right, and deflation, ignore that. Deflation in this country only happens in the 1930s. We need a major depression to cause deflation. Isn't going to happen. We're going to have inflation of 2% a year, 1.5%, whatever, as long as we can look out ahead. Second issue is the Fed and interest rates. And I'm going to try to shorten this so we get through it. I don't know when the Fed is going to, QE3 is now over. I don't know when the Fed's going to start raising short-term interest rates. But remember this, they won't be raising them to stop inflation or reduce inflation or prevent inflation, nor are they going to raise them because the economy is growing too rapidly, which could lead to inflation. They're going to raise them only to get short-term interest rates back to a normal range instead of zero, or close to zero. As a result, they're going to take their time. They will probably start doing it 25 basis points at a meeting, the federal funds rate and the discount rate as well. And at the next meeting, unless the economy's changed a lot, they'll do another 25 basis points. Most likely, they'll do that for roughly 8 meetings. So from mid-2015 to mid-2016, most likely we'll get something in the range of a 2 percentage point increase in short-term interest rates. At the long end, and talking about structural changes in the economy, if you go back 40 or 50 years ago, long-term interest rates in this country never rose until the Fed did something at the short end. If the Fed raised short-term interest rates, long-term interest rates would follow, at least directionally, not necessarily every basis point for basis point. And when they did the opposite, long-term rates would go down. In the last 30 years, every single shift in the direction of interest rates has started in the long end of the market, the Treasury market. The Treasury market is now a trading market. 40 years ago, it was an investment market. You bought long-term Treasuries as an investment vehicle. Some people still do that now, but it's much more a trading market. You know, and I haven't updated this number. I looked at it about 7-8 years ago, the amount of trading in the Treasury bond market. The average 10-year Treasury changed hands every 9 minutes. That's how much trading there. And there's 13 billion, now there's whatever it is, 16 billion. Of treasuries out there, some of which are owned overseas, as you know. So my best guess is sometime over the next 6 to 9 months, long-term rates will start going up. They would have already been going up, except for what's happening in foreign countries. Some of you may know this. Long-term interest rates in almost every major country in the United States and some of the non-major industrialized countries have gone down dramatically. If we take the eight biggest economies outside the US, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Australia, whatever, our 10-year treasury, which is now yielding about 2% plus 235, is up a full percent higher than the average elsewhere. In Germany, it's 1.5%. Their current 10-year treasury rate is 0.9%. Never has happened before. As a result, we had by far the biggest flow of investment capital from overseas into the U.S. bond market, and some of it the stock market, than in our history, and our biggest sales of U.S.-owned foreign bonds in our history. That's what's keeping interest rates lower. Plus, the deficit this year is lower and so forth, but that's the major factor. Sooner, you know, those economies are relatively soft. Sooner or later, those rates will probably go up, and when they go up, ours will go up, and probably will precede the Fed, you know, by a few months. So what I'm talking about, if talk a year or two from now, two or three years from now, short-term rates will be 2 or 2.5 points higher than they are. Long rates, somewhere between 1% and 1.5% higher. That's sort of the general outline that I see. What about what's happening in Washington, then oil, and then the stock market? Despite, I mean, this was a clean sweep for the Republicans, yet despite it was just about average historically for the minority party's gains in an off-year election when the president of the other party is in power. It was a little smaller than normal, than average in the House and a little bigger than average in the Senate. But combining the two, not that unusual. But it will obviously cause change going forward. Here's what I see, and this is partly based on sketchy information, which I don't necessarily put a lot of credence in, partly my own opinion. But before I say that, here's what you're not going to see. There are at least three senators who are likely to run for the Republican nomination in 2016. There are 9 or 10 Republican senators that are up for re-election next year in states that are normally blue states. So that will temper any kind of behavior from the Senate going forward, in my opinion. There's now talk of the Republicans ending the filibuster process. Be a little ironic since they've used it far more than any minority party has historically, by a lot. That's not going to happen. There's talk of another government shutdown if Obama takes executive action on immigration, or if they don't like his budget, whatever. Not going to happen, I don't think. What will happen, particularly on the issues that are of relevance for you, Keystone Pipeline, the Republicans will pass it when the new Congress comes in power in comes in session in late January. The president will veto it. My best guess is after 3, 4, or 5 months of haggling, it will pass, but it will include some environmental, whatever you want to call it, protections that are not now in the bill. I don't know exactly what they be. I can tell you, for a matter of fact, that the White House has been looking at what they can do to address some of the environmental concerns. I think it's a good shot it's going to happen. Some of you may be against it, some of you may be for it, and there are reasons for both, but from where I sit, there's a good chance it will happen. Secondly, I think oil exports, which are now somewhat restricted, any company will be able to export crude, and now they can do refined products as we go forward. I don't know when the legislation will be submitted and passed, but I'm pretty sure within the next few months that will take place. Thirdly, tax reform. The administration would like to do corporate tax reform by lowering the top corporate tax rate, which is now 35%, to somewhere in the mid-20s, but they will only do it if tax preferences, tax credits, maybe in some case tax loopholes, are tightened so that revenues don't fall. And that, you know, if that happens, it's very possible that some of the oil and gas industry tax credits will be changed. My best guess is it won't happen because I don't think the Republicans want to reduce those tax credits and preferences. So I'd put the odds less than 50% we're going to see corporate tax reform. And by the way, while the corporate tax rate is 35%, most corporations pay a fraction of that. Some pay zero. They might pass sort of an alternative minimum tax for corporations along the lines in the individual taxes. But I don't think we're going to have large corporate tax reform that will dramatically change some of the tax code that is now in place. Just largely a guess. There was some talk earlier about, one other thing the Republicans will target immediately, rolling back some of the EPA regulations on power plants, use of coal, you know, and emissions, mercury, sulfur, whatever. Whether they'll be successful or not, I don't know, but they're going to make a very strong attempt to do that. Last thing is the Affordable Care Act. The Republicans will try to gut the entire thing. I don't think that will happen, but I'm pretty sure there will be two changes. Number one, the tax on medical devices, 3%, sort of an excise tax on those products, which helps finance some of the subsidies inherent in the program, will be eliminated. And secondly, the part-time, full-time split in hours per week will move higher. That's been a bone of contention, and I'm pretty sure that will change going forward. I don't think any of these changes, and certainly there won't be any big tax cuts, tax increases, big spending programs, whatever, will change the impact of the federal government on overall economic growth. It'll be relatively neutral going forward. Okay. Let me talk about oil and gas. And I think you all know better than I do probably what's happened. We obviously now have surplus production, depending upon whose numbers you believe, of somewhere in the million barrels a day. Libya increased their production back toward normal. Obviously, U.S. production is up. Iran, I don't know who Iran is selling it to with all these sanctions, probably Japan and China. They've increased production. Some of the current surplus reflects seasonal factors. This is a low oil consumption season, particularly driving goes down after Labor Day. Some of it reflects weak demand, particularly because of these other countries, China, Japan, most of Western Europe are growing very slowly. And some of it reflects the production increases I talked about. I believe OPEC is now trying to put a package together which will include themselves, Kuwait, Qatar, and the Emirates for a production cut of somewhere 800,000 barrels a day, maybe a little more. The Saudis will do half of that, and they expect the other three to do 150 or 200,000 barrels a day. Those other three countries, as you know, are small population, large oil-producing countries. They can afford, you know, selling less oil, probably more than all the other OPEC members, especially countries like Venezuela. And there's some talk that the OPEC oil minister is trying to talk Russia into making some contribution toward those cuts. I didn't get this from the federal government. I don't know anybody in Saudi Arabia. I don't know the oil minister. I know people in the oil industry who are relatively well informed. That's my best guess as to what is going to happen. They will limit it. They will say it's a three-month program to get us through this seasonally low period, or 6 months or whatever, because, you know, they want other producers to think that prices may go back down again and, you know, not start up as many oil projects as they might be. And the question is, if it stays at 75, and by the way, the Saudis appear to be targeting $90 a barrel as the 9X crude as the price target. There's some evidence that the rig count has dropped a little bit and some companies are moving back from new exploration. The other side of it is, you know, the cost of fracking seems to be going down. My guess is if it stays at 75, you'll see some cuts in production in the U.S. I don't think they're going to be dramatic. For the next 3 or 4 months, I think increases are in the cards. But if they, you know, start fewer new wells and newer drilling, you might see a small decline. If it goes to 50 or 60, that's a whole different kettle of fish. And I doubt if that's going to happen. Stock, or natural gas, depends on the winter. In the Northeast, most heating is fueled by heating oil. In the Midwest, it's almost all natural gas. And if there's a cold winter, it'll be very helpful. It started out cold in the last week or two. It'll help natural gas. If not, natural gas is going to go down because supplies are huge. So this is a very far more than oil, weather-sensitive product. The stock market. I mentioned a minute ago that there are some people who've talked about stock market's going to collapse because QE3 is over and it was all that liquidity that pushed up. No way. This stock market has been driven by the increase in corporate earnings. One of the unusual other factors of this recovery period is that corporate earnings have gone up dramatically while jobs and consumer income have gone up so slowly. and its earnings that have fueled the growth in the increase in the stock market. And I'll give you one way of confirming that. If you go back for the last 60 or 70 years and correlate the U.S. stock market with valuations, you know, measures like price-earnings ratios, interest rates, inflation, the market always does better when interest rates and inflation are low. You make the and the growth in earnings, which I almost forgot, the stock market is now probably 5 or 6% undervalued. And by the way, the current P/E ratio on trailing earnings is about 17. Going back to 1950, it's averaged 16, a little above 16. So some people are alarmed by that. Well, it got back to the average, even a little above. If the stock market, every stock market rally only ended when we got back to the historical average valuation, that historical valuation would, PE would now be 2 or something. Because it would mean that, you know, we'd hit the average, market would then go down on the next downturn, that over time would bring the average down. Then we go to the lower average next time, and then that, in every single bull market we've ever had, PE ratios go well above the average. If not the average, as I say, it would be much lower. If you believe with what I said, that the economy is going to grow in the 3% range for the next several years, if that happens, you're going to see corporate earnings growth 6-7% a year. That is enough to bring the market higher. The big gains are gone. That was all catch-up in 2011. I'm not talking about Heinz catch-up. That was a catch-up. The market was down. As I said, the market discounted the end of the world in 2009. It is now caught up almost. Now it's a matter of needing the market, the economy to continue to do well. I think if earnings grow 6 or 7%, stock prices will rise 7 or 8%, and valuations will gradually move a little bit higher. If you disagree with that, the market will tank, like it always does in recession. So that's the key factor. I'm going to make one last comment then quit, because I'm probably at a way past my time. And by the way, if that wasn't sufficient, look at the macro case now for the stock market above what I just talked about. Not only low interest rates, low inflation, stronger economic growth, corporate earnings growth, companies are buying back. You know, over the last 5 years on average, the number of stocks, the number of, what's the word, the amount of stock owned is down by 3.5%. If you take the S&P 500 companies, as a result of all these buybacks, the amount of shares outstanding is down 15% over the last 5 years. So that pushes up earnings per share above what just is happening to earnings. By the way, IBM down 45%. They've been keeping that stock where it is by just buying back shares. Other companies are doing it to some extent as well. Secondly, have you noticed dividends? The last 3 years, dividends paid out by S&P 500 companies have risen 12% per year. And that lifts up prices of many stocks. And on top of that, you know, if you buy Procter & Gamble now, you can get more than 3% dividend, higher than the 10-year Treasury. They've raised their dividend 40 straight years. So that tends to help the stock market. And it's a significant factor, as I mentioned earlier. And by the way, companies have so much cash, they're either using it to buy back stock, increase dividends, or start investing it. All are good for the stock market. Last comment about corporate planning. You know, when I started at IBM 50 years ago, corporate planning was merely numbers. We took every product, predicted 10 years ahead how much we were going to sell, how much copper we needed, how much this, how much space, how many workers. And then we went next year and redid it. And the first 2 years would be the operating budget and the long-term strategic budget. That's passe. You have to do some of that. But the essence of corporate planning now, particularly in how volatile and uncertain the world economy has become and how competitive it's become, is companies are increasingly focused on what are the key things I have to do to be successful? What are the things that could drag me down, and how do I overcome them? What are my competitors going to be do? Really, the key issues that will determine the health of the economy of the company. And secondly, corporate planning is no longer a once-a-year activity in October and November. It has to be an ongoing activity. because none of us can forecast perfectly, whether it's the economy or any company forecasting its business. But there are ways to minimize the impact of incorrect forecasts on the company. And probably the most effective way is to monitor your business. If you go off track and your sales are weaker than you thought, and you can demonstrate that it has nothing to do with factors that you factored into that forecast, something else is going on, and that it's likely to continue, the sooner you recognize that, the sooner you can take corrective action. Avoid increasing your resources. Find ways to stimulate more spending with various programs, more spending on your product. Risk management has become the number one activity in most companies. What if my forecast is wrong? How much will it hurt me? Can I afford to take that risk? How do I mitigate those risks? And I'm going to be on top of the business every single day, so if things are changing, I will recognize it as soon as possible. And as I mentioned earlier, planning your business in most industries without any price increases, figuring out ways to become more cost-effective year after year, looking at other markets, differentiating yourself from your competitors, because there are so many competitors now in most industries. Those are the things that most companies have to do to be successful in this world. And even if I'm right, by the way, the economy grows more rapidly over the next 3 years, doesn't mean you can sit by your phone and the phone's going to ring and there'll be a million orders. You got to be aggressive, and you got to be not passive, and you got to be proactive. And on that basis, I apologize for going too long, but good luck, happy Thanksgiving, and a healthy and happy New Year.